Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The economy is in a ditch. The U.S. powerhouse feels powered down. So where's the innovation, the entrepreneurial spark that will launch it again? We've had steam engines, electricity, transistors, computers. What next? What now to change the world, to kickstart the economy? This hour On Point, we'll talk with innovators, entrepreneurs about their big ideas and relaunching the U.S. economy. You can join the conversation. Where do you see the next big breakthroughs? Will they be green? Will they be American? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear in this hour from three entrepreneurs with strong track records of innovation. But joining me first in the studio is Harvard Business School professor Bill Solomon, scholar and legendary guru of entrepreneurship. Bill Solomon, thanks very much for being here.
It's great to be here, Tom.
We clearly need something. We need some new fuel. You know, the consumer drove it for a long time. Debt drove it for a long time. We have a history of very big innovations coming along, changing the game and fueling this economy to quite incredible heights. Is it out there this time? Are the innovations, the entrepreneurs, you know, in the wings or on the runway to help us get this thing back in gear?
I think there are two ways to frame it. First of all, the world has given us an almost inexhaustible supply of problems. So the environment, healthcare, education, we could go through the list.
Problem equals opportunity.
Problem equals opportunity. Every entrepreneur is out there saying, if there's a problem with greenhouse gases, how can I solve that problem?
So great. We're in deep trouble. All kinds of...
It's terrific. It's good news. Half full versus half empty.
That's good.
And that's an orientation that, in fact, is uniquely American, mm-hmm. although increasingly spread to other countries.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you looked at big pockets of opportunity, there's still great things to be done around healthcare,
mm-hmm.
around the life sciences side, but also around the health services delivery. Great things to be done still with the internet. It's still explosive and has not yet been fully exploited.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, around green businesses. And by green businesses, I mean companies that address some aspect of energy or independence from mm-hmm. foreign oil sources or creating jobs in the U.S. and a steady supply of oil at a predictable price. So opportunity is everywhere.
A steady supply of energy at a predictable price.
Right, correct.
Two big issues there, timing and scale. I don't know whether there's something in this basket you've just described that can come in quickly enough to make a difference in the near term. And when these do come on stream, do you see the scale in these opportunities for innovation to refloat this economy in a big way?
I do. So I could give a couple of examples. If you just take the internet, there's a new company in New York called Gilt.com. It was founded in 2007. This year, it'll do about $500 million.
Gilt as in guilty or golden?
G-I-L-T
okay.
dot com.
Oh, boy. A new toy for the rich? What's that mean?
They run private sales of fashion merchandise, and they've expanded into other categories. So at noon, they have a sale where they put high-end fashion merchandise on sale, and people go on and buy it. I went to visit the company the other day. They were hiring 15 people a week. So the internet,
that's jobs.
15 jobs per week in New York. And a large number of those jobs had to do with logistics and support because they're shipping out of their Brooklyn warehouse 30,000 items per day.
Okay, this 15 jobs a week, that's good. We can use all the jobs we can get. It may be a very successful company. Maybe they'll have an IPO and the founders will get rich. But is this the next steam engine, the next Thomas Edison? I mean, online shopping for the rich, is that really going to be the thing that, you know, boosts us back into business?
Well, I think online shopping for the rich is one way to describe it, democratizing access to high-end fashion goods at a very discounted price, which is completely consonant with what we need in the U.S. And if you think about all the innovations in retail over time, beginning with the catalog, beginning with the department store, they have been about democratizing access to goods. So this is, like Amazon is, another example. Now, it's also an example where someone might lose in the economy, so it's not the net gain of 15 jobs. There may be some other group that doesn't have as many jobs as they had before.
Schumpeter's creative destruction. Startups create jobs, but they eat up old ventures.
It's churn, so there are lots of successes, lots of failures. It turns out job growth is heavily dependent on new businesses, not small businesses or large businesses, per se. So new businesses are critical, and as long as they produce more jobs than they cut out of other businesses, then we're in great shape.
That's an interesting angle, and we always hear about small businesses being the big generator of jobs in this country, but new reports out saying yes, but it's really the new small businesses that are most importantly doing that.
Right, and if you thought in the clean tech space, you're going to have people who create alternative fuels. So, for example, there are attempts in the U.S. to create biofuels that will sell for $1 per gallon equivalent with gasoline, will be produced domestically, will not harm some crop like corn or have unintended consequences, will be produced in fallow land, and will provide a great number of benefits. For example, we're not going to import oil from Venezuela or Iran. We're not going to ship dollars overseas. We're not going to have unpredictability because that dollar will turn out to be a fixed price. That is, next year it's going to be a buck. The year after it's going to be a buck. Hugely important.
So when your friends say to you, Bill Salmon, you know the world of innovation and entrepreneurship well, is it going to save our bacon? You say, yeah, we've got a lot of big stuff coming on stream. It's going to power this U.S. economy like you've never seen. Or do you say, I don't know?
At any moment in time, it's very easy to paint an incredibly bad picture. And as you know, we got as close to the chasm as we could possibly get, backed away a little bit. And we seem to be a little closer than I would hope.
At this point in the
so-called
recovery.
At this point in the economic cycle. So what I look at is to say, are there game-changing innovations out there that can create value for everyone in the U.S. and all around the world? So, for example, if you could cure a disease or help someone be productive longer in their life. Diabetes is a simple illustration. We've got $250 billion per year cost for diabetes.
Wow.
We spend under $1 billion on all research on diabetes. In business, if you had a $250 billion cost stream growing at 10% per year, you would spend more to try to cure that disease. Now, part of it is behavior around obesity and the like, but rather it's an example of something where expenditures of dollars have the prospect of dramatically lowering that cost and improving the lives of all the people who have diabetes.
Bill Salmon, you've got a big view. We want to dive into some actual startups that are going on. Sitting here, right here with us in the studio now, is entrepreneur Eric Geiler. He is CEO of the startup Y-Tricity, which is working on the wireless transmission of electrical power, electrical current right through the air. The company has $15 million in venture backing, 25 employees now. Eric was founder of Brook Trout, a pioneer in voicemail technology, chairman of Groove Mobile, a mobile music venture. Eric Geiler, thanks very much for being here. Welcome back to One Point, I should say.
Thanks, Tom.
So this sounds pretty amazing. Electricity right through the air, like what?
Well, it's a little hard to get your head around.
Yeah.
But Y-Tricity, wireless electricity, the last thing to go wireless. But what we're doing is not putting electricity in the air, but very light density magnetic fields discovered by a professor at MIT several years ago who was wakened by his wife's cell phone as it ran out of battery power, something most of us are familiar with. About the third night in a row, it woke him up beeping. He was thinking, with all this electricity running around in the walls, why couldn't some of it go into the phone? And he actually figured out how to do it.
Without a wire.
Without a wire.
Now, you say it's light-density magnetic fields, but one way or another, the electricity passes through those fields, through the quote-unquote air where that magnetic density is. So it would go from my wall to my phone. I wouldn't have to plug it in to recharge it or to appliances all over the house?
Sure. I mean, think about anything with a cord or a battery are candidates for being replaced. It's the last thing in the world to go wireless is power.
I saw this compared somewhere to try and get a head around how this works. And I remember this from talking about Nikola Tesla. He thought of powering, you know, sending vast quantities of power all over the place. But this is related to how when a great, I don't know, alto, you know, belt tower aria, she can break that wine glass.
That's right.
Because the frequency sort of matches up and the energy of her voice is able to travel to the material of that glass. It's related to that as a metaphor anyway?
That's a perfect metaphor, actually. That's a form of acoustic resonance. We're mm-hmm. using resonance in the magnetic domain. But remember when you were a child, when almost anybody that ever got on a swing remembers that magical feeling they got when the swing started going, and what you were really doing was moving your feet at the resonant frequency of the swing.
Okay.
If you went too fast or too slowly, it wouldn't work. So using this in the magnetic domain, magnetic fields are basically safe
yes.
for human beings.
Right,
we
right.
live in a magnetic
Short
field.
Short distance
the Earth.
In particular. Uh-huh.
And we live in one.
Right,
the Earth.
Of course. Yeah.
And
Northern
so,
lights and all the rest.
So from cell phones to these new generation of electric cars, where imagine, if you will, we're building systems now in Watertown. You yep. drive into your garage.
Mm-hmm.
You get out of your car starts charging because there is a mat on the floor of your garage, and it powers 3 kilowatts into your car completely
no
safely
plug,
and efficiently.
No wire, just pull in and it's doing its thing.
No wire.
Might do the same thing with, I don't know, what, a pacemaker or a television or you name it.
Implanted medical devices is a perfect application. So if you think of devices that have batteries that power the medical devices, if you have to put the battery outside the human body, ultimately, people suffer from infections because of that.
We got just a few seconds before the break. It's definitely innovative. Is it a big deal?
It's probably one of the biggest breakthroughs in science in the last decade, and it will become mainstream in our lifetime. So over the next 5 years, imagine walking into your house and your cell phone charges in your pocket.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about innovation with American entrepreneurs, asking what will restart the U.S. economy, asking if they will do it, the entrepreneurs. With me in the studio here in Boston, Bill Salmon, professor at Harvard Business School, and Eric Geiler, CEO of Y-Tricity. They're developing wireless electrical transmission technology. And it is on the way. You've heard a little bit about what that might bring us. With us now from San Mateo, California, is Donna Dubinsky, one of Silicon Valley's most successful entrepreneurs. She's co-founder and CEO of Numenta, which creates software that can learn in the same way that the human brain does, thereby solving, in theory and more, a class of problems that today's computers cannot solve. Numenta launched in 2005, 10 employees, no outside funding. She and her co-founder Jeff Hawkins provided that. They're the very successful co-founders of Palm, which developed the first commercially successful PDA, personal digital assistant, Palm Pilot, all that, and of Handspring, which developed the Trio smartphone. Donna Dubinsky in California, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Happy to be here.
So what's the tiger you hope, I guess, we hope, that you've got by the tail now? How does this, what is Numenta?
Well, we're creating a new computing platform. We have a pretty big mission here. We're trying to reinvent computing yet again and create a platform that lets us make computers more intelligent than they are. You know, intelligent more the way we humans are intelligent than the way computers classically have worked.
And it's supposed to be something that imitates the way the human brain learns. How, Donna? And what's the advantage of that?
Well, you know, human brains are pretty different than computers and how they've worked in the past. You know, in human brains are very impacted by noise and so on, or human brains are very robust to noise. So if you were to see a dog, for example, you'd see a dog's head and not the rest of the dog. You didn't see four legs and a tail. You'd still know it was a dog, even though you don't see four legs and a tail. And that's the sort of thing that really trips up a computer. A computer just can't figure that out. If there's a lot of noise or occlusion, a computer doesn't do prediction very well. The computer you know, sort of has to deal with just what it has today, yet a human is constantly doing prediction in everything that you do. I mean, they really work quite differently. So we're trying to pattern a computer program that it's inspired by the brain. We're not trying to build brains
mm-hmm.
or artificial brains or anything, but it's inspired by this algorithm, if you will, in the brain that figures out all those kind of things and operates that same way. So, you know, today if you search images on the web and you search for dog in Google image search or something like that, You're not ever searching the image itself. You're not actually looking at the image. You're searching text that a human somewhere,
right,
someplace.
Because a computer wouldn't recognize the image.
Yeah, the computer, no computer can tell the difference between a cat and a dog,
okay,
in an image, which is something a three-year-old can do reliably. So you know, that's the kind of problem that we're trying to struggle with. And I use images as an example because it's the easiest to understand. But it's really irrespective of sensory data. I mean, this could be audio, this could be just text, this could be all sorts of data. And in the end, in essence, what you're trying to do is find patterns in massive amounts of data. I mean, that information that's coming in on your retina every second as your eyes move, as your bodies move, as the object moves around you, is a huge amount of data, and you're finding a pattern in it that says dog. And we're trying to find patterns in data like that.
Donna Dubinsky, when you say you're out to reinvent computing, that certainly sounds big. That sounds like enormous scale. And you give us an example of cat and dog differentiation, and people may scratch their heads and wonder, you know, we've got a lot of computer power already. If you're successful, what would the applications be? How would it change the way the world works? What would the economic value be?
Well, let me give you some examples of the sort of applications that we've actually worked on and talked to people about. We've worked with an auto manufacturer on pedestrian detection, trying to make cars smarter to see pedestrians around them. We're working with a company that does digital pathology. So right now they scan pathology specimens and put them into computers, but still human pathologists have to go look at them to find if there's an area that's problematic. You know, could we do that automatically? We're working with a major international bank on credit card fraud. If somebody does fraud the way they've done it in the past, they can create rules around that to look in credit card streams. But the fraud people are pretty clever, and they keep inventing new kinds of frauds. And so what they really need is a learning system that does anomaly detection, says, okay, something different's going on here. We better figure out what it is. We've worked with a partner on web click prediction, try to figure out, okay, if somebody's going through a website, where are they likely to click next so I can help serve them up the information that they're going to need or give them ads that make sense for them. We talk to a lot of people in the medical world, things like drug discovery. A lot of drugs are killed even after, you know, $1 billion of investment because they harm some people but not others, and they haven't been able to really find those patterns. Why do they harm some people and not others? There's a huge amount of data that they can't find the patterns in. It's just the list goes on and
right,
on. It's
right.
been amazing to me over the 5 years we've been working on this, how many people have come to us with such a wide variety of applications that they've been frustrated with current computing technology.
Well, I get that, Donna. Let me ask you, Donna, if I may. I mean, those all sound like valuable applications, really magnetic opportunities. Then take it on up from there. I mean, if it's reinventing computing, does this ascend to the level of game changer? Could this be something that fires an economy as big as the American economy at scale? Think about steam engine, you know, electricity, transistors, the rest. Are you playing in that league?
You know, I think we do have an opportunity to have that kind of impact, but I think it will take many years. It's not going to solve the recession in, you know, 2011.
Right, right.
You know, when you look at the scale of major inventions and how long they take to really have that kind of impact, it's short in some sense and long in others. I mean, the Internet really started 15 years ago. Now, from a historical perspective, that's incredibly short, 15 years. And, you know, wow, look at the enormous changes in our world. But certainly from any given year, you know, it doesn't solve what's going on in that year's economy. Same thing, you know, smartphones. I was involved in the smartphone business, and, you know, we shipped the first smartphones about 10 years ago. So, you know, 10 years later, we're really seeing an enormous impact in the economy from that sector. So I think we're in kind of that same boat that, you know, we're looking in a 5 to 10 year time frame of having a pretty big impact. But I'm afraid it won't help create jobs tomorrow.
Tomorrow's okay as long as we know it's coming. I mean, I think the unsettling thing to a lot of Americans is people saying, you know, we don't have the next big thing out there. It's not on the way. It's not on the rails. Let me just canvass each of the three of you, and I'll start with you, Donna. collectively, you know entrepreneurship and innovation well. You're right there in Silicon Valley. Do you see across the board in this country a crop of innovation coming sufficient to float this country's very big boat, I don't know, in the first half of this century, never mind next year?
Oh, absolutely. I think there are major, major areas of innovation going on. You know, Bill touched on a few of them that I agree with. First of all, in the healthcare and medical field, enormous amount of interesting things going on with genomics and personalized medicine, and still yet with medical devices. And, you know, Eric touched on another major area of energy, and I think that very, very exciting work is being done in all respects. I mean, I just spoke with somebody who's creating a company that creates software that models all the needs of a building and manages a building from all of its climate with lots of little sensors all around the building. That's the kind of thing our technology will be really good at helping with, is something that deals with lots of sensory data. So that's why I was talking with him. But, I mean, that's an example of innovation in the energy area that's still kind of computing and IT. So, you know, I think those two, medical, genomics and health, as well as energy, are the two, besides intelligent computing, that I think offer tremendous promise.
Eric Geiler, let me bring it to you. You've got Ytricity. Donna Dubinsky has Numenta. Look right across the horizon. Do you see enough horsepower in the innovation engine in this country to really power this economy? People are, you know, in kind of a millennial malaise thinking about it. But is it out there?
I would say absolutely. So if you just look across the entrepreneurial community and the game changers that have gone on, mm-hmm. I mean, things that didn't exist 20 years ago that are now huge parts of our economy, whether it's Google, Cisco, these things were startup companies that have had a profound effect. They're American. By the way, you said float the boat of this country. Mm-hmm. I'd actually contend we're talking about floating the world's boat here.
What is it? Is that on our shoulders, too? There's innovation all over now.
Well, I mean, you know, world is flat and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, when I look at just our company's opportunities, I've spent most of my time traveling, actually, in the last 2 years to Japan, Korea, China, Taiwan, where there's a lot of manufacturing. But the technology is coming from the United States, and it's created here. And so you have to consider every place in the world.
Everybody needs innovation going on. We're not the only ones that do it. Bill Salmon, there's a lot to unpack right there. But on this question of whether we've got enough horsepower in the innovation engine in this country, okay, there's the world, but let's just get our economy going first. We know it's all interrelated. Do you see enough out there?
Well, everybody said absolutely, and I would say absolutely maybe.
We don't want to be Pollyanna-ish here. You know, there's...
No. There are a lot of things that are uncertain in the current economy. For example, I can't tell you what tax rates are going to be next year. I can't tell you what healthcare costs are going to be. I can't tell you a lot of things. And where that uncertainty is actually corrosive for people who are trying to start new businesses.
Do the tax rates really matter? What, they were 70% or something at the top end when Steve Jobs and Bill Gates started their ventures? Didn't stop them.
Sure. At the... they have no impact. So I've never seen someone say, now that capital gains rate are 15% instead of 20%, mm-hmm. I'm ready to go. Now, mm-hmm. that's the thing that caused me to go. But rather, uncertainty is corrosive. And there's so many aspects of public policy today, including about a carbon tax or other aspects of policy around energy, that it's very hard for people to have the predictability in an already extraordinarily risky kind of business.
Is it an issue of a yes or no on carbon tax, or just some answer, some clarity?
Some answer would be useful. And again, what I always think of is the elasticity of innovation, by which I mean if you have a certain set of characteristics of an opportunity, what will happen? So imagine that you had very high-cost computing. Well, the innovation that was induced was personal computers, or currently other versions like the iPad. So I think any time you have an opportunity because you have predictability, and carbon tax would produce predictability. If we set a price and allowed the carbon tax to vary, then you would have predictability and you would find all manner of people doing useful innovations that would change the world change the American economy.
Let's get our callers in right here. Buffalo, New York. Dave, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I wish to disagree with the person on carbon taxes and also some of the other aspects about, you know, these derivative economic things like software and medical as a way to stimulate the U.S. I mean, we have basic problems in that our economy requires energy, and without energy as a physical basis to do things, we're kind of floundering. And due to peak oil and carbon dioxide pollution, we have problems with the existing way.
So but Bill Salmon's looking at synthetic options there as well, non-polluting options there. You're not for that?
I am, but in order to make renewable energy possible, you have to actually make it economically viable. And in Europe and in Ontario, they've actually figured out how to make it economically viable. They've basically allowed a price for energy to be a function of the cost to produce it plus a reasonable profit, and these are called feed-in laws.
But so price energy up so that, that's fixed and leaves room for development beneath. We'll look at it. I mean, Eric, this is kind of in your bailiwick. I mean, we have heard venture capital folks in California saying, oh, you know, please put a price on carbon. Then it gives us headroom to compete on developing new alternative energies. What about it? Do we need that?
Well, I guess going back to what Bill said before, entrepreneurs are always optimistic people. And taxes, in sort of whatever form they are really not part of the decision-making process. The economics are.
But economics are vital when it comes to alternative energies.
Right.
I mean, if oil costs 2 cents a gallon, you can't profitably develop an alternative.
Well, let me just give you an example of sort of one of the things that people haven't considered. Let's look at disposable batteries. I don't want to pick on a AA battery, but let's pick on it for a second.
Okay.
A AA battery, according to a study done in 2006 in the UK, we built 40 billion disposable batteries in the world.
And then
consumed
had to dispose
them,
of them.
And where did they go?
Yeah.
We don't even want to know where that crap went because it's killing us, all of us.
Now, you're
and,
saying with your company, Y-Tricity, well, you wouldn't need a battery for that
right.
flashlight. Just leave it next to the wall. It'll be recharged.
And if you normalize the price of the delivering power through a disposable battery, it's about $300 per kilowatt hour. In Massachusetts, we pay 10 cents a kilowatt hour.
So there's a big change you can make right there.
3,000 times.
There's a big bit of leverage. Donna, let me put – here's a web comment for you. This is from Joshua. It says, what difference does it make? It will all be outsourced and manufactured in China, where these rich innovators can manufacture it with slave labor and once again betray the American worker and the American prosperity. But, I mean, that's a harsh way of putting it. But I think, Donna, a lot of people do wonder these days. We innovate. They manufacture. What about the jobs and the economic benefit, Donna?
Well, you know, I think all businesses, big businesses of any scale at this point, are global in nature. I mean, you look at a lot of the great companies in the IT sector, IBM, HP, all the companies, really, Cisco. They all have substantial international operations and substantial American operations. They have plants all over the world, and many of them have plants in the U.S. They have design centers all over the world as well as in the U.S.
Will Americans get a big enough piece of that pie, Donna, in that case? You hear the skepticism in our web posters comment.
Well, you know, I understand that, and it's hard transitions, and jobs do shift from one place to another. But in the end, it's good for us for other economies to grow around the world as well. They create demand for our products as well. Prosperous economies around the world will create more stability and less war and strife and so on. And, you know, I'm just a believer, basically, that it's good for the world that other economies prosper as well. Now, we have to stay competitive, and we have to keep inventing, and we have to, you know, create good jobs in this country and a good standard of living. But I don't think it's good for us if others in the world are suffering.
Donna Dubinsky, co-founder and CEO of Numenta. Donna, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about innovation with American entrepreneurs asking what will restart the U.S. economy, asking if they will do it, the entrepreneurs. We've been talking with Bill Salmon of the Harvard Business School, Eric Geiler, who's CEO of Y-Tricity. They're looking to send electricity via magnetic field right through the air, wireless transmission, at least inside your house. We'll talk about how big that field might be. Joining us as well in the studio right now is Andrew Perlman. He's president of Great Point Energy, which converts coal into natural gas and sequesters the CO2, the carbon dioxide, that is so rough on the atmosphere. The company was founded in 2004, has 35 employees now, has raised $150 million in venture financing. Would be a big green step forward. Not all the way, but a big step if it got widely applied. Andrew Pullman, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
What's your vision for Great Point Energy?
Well, we were looking at the world and trying to figure out the simplest way to reduce pollution and prevent climate change on a global scale. And we said, boy, coal provides 50% of our electricity in this country and significantly more in places like China and India. Mm-hmm. And so if we wanted to be able to improve the environment, we had to focus on coal.
50% of the energy and a whole lot of the pollutants.
Exactly. It's the single biggest cause of air pollution and global warming emissions in the world today.
So Great Point would essentially convert coal somehow into effectively natural gas?
So our goal was to say we have this incredible resource that's abundant and inexpensive. But it's polluting. So if we can figure out how to turn it into the cleanest commercial fuel, which is natural gas, instead of burning it, we could have a huge impact. Natural gas is so clean you burn it in your kitchen without a vent. It's the cleanest fuel that we use today.
So that's a great environmental advance if we can pull it off. What about the economic implications of this? As you said, most of the coal-fired plants in the world today, extant and coming on stream, are not in this country. So you can do all your business abroad?
So we wanted to be able to be economic without any government incentives. We wanted to be able to compete on its own 2 feet. And one of the nice things is that natural gas is vastly more valuable than coal. It burns much cleaner and much more efficiently. Mm-hmm. So you get about twice as much electricity for the same amount of energy that you burn. And so here in the United States, Powder River Basin coal, which is our most abundant resource in Wyoming, costs between 50 cents and a dollar per million BTU. Natural gas is between $4 and $5. So you've got a really nice margin there. In China, coal costs about the same, maybe a little bit more, but the natural gas sells at oil parity. So it's $11 or $12 per million BTU. So you have a huge margin. And the same thing in India and other parts of the world.
Now, you know, it's still a fossil fuel that you're going to be using here. You're going to have skeptics who say, come on, this isn't the alternative energy we want. We want to get all the way off of fossil fuels. You'll still have, you know, greenhouse gases from yours as well. Less than coal, but what do you say to that?
So we felt like the simplest way was hard enough. You know, we could go all the way to hydrogen. In fact, our technology does allow us to take all of the carbon out of the coal and just make pure hydrogen, where, you know, water is your only emission. But there's no infrastructure for burning hydrogen or moving hydrogen or anything else. You know, natural gas is mostly hydrogen, 4 parts hydrogen to 1 part carbon, versus coal, which is almost entirely carbon. So you're producing about 60% less CO2 emissions for the same amount of electricity. And so we felt, rather than trying to move a boulder up a mountain, we could have a huge impact simply by going not all the way, but going nearly all the way by making natural gas.
Talk about jobs and the U.S. economy. What would this mean if it rolls out widely?
For
American jobs and the American economy.
Well, we think it has a big impact in the U.S. and abroad. So certainly all of the technology development, all of the demonstrations, all of that is taking place in the United States. You know, we've raised $150 million so far. All of that has been poured back into the American economy. And we have a lot further to go, all of which will be used to build demonstration plants and projects here in the U.S. An average project for us is probably $2 billion. And we're planning to build many, many projects. So if we're successful, it will have a big impact here in the U.S.
So the fact that you're in China all the time, raising money and looking to sell this, doesn't mean it won't work for this economy as well?
Well, so far, all of the money that we've raised has come out of the United States and North America.
You don't have any Chinese investors?
We don't have any Chinese investors currently. However, the next stage, as we go to raise the next round of funding, which is going to be in the hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, that is going to involve raising money from sovereign wealth funds, from countries, from governments, and from major oil companies around the world. And we do think, for us, that the biggest market is in places like China and India, because they're using even more coal and growing even faster than we are. So it does mean jobs in the U.S. It means jobs overseas, but it also means money coming back from foreign countries to the U.S. as we get licensing fees and other engineering work.
Eric Geiler, what about the balance of your company's Y-Tricity's activity? You're also spending plenty of time, I assume, in China, Taiwan. That's where the appliances get built. If they're going to be able to pull this electricity out of the wall, out of the air without a wire, they're going to have to be built there to do it. So what's the American payoff?
Well, the American payoff is high-paying jobs here, and it's the knowledge workers that create it. Now, by the way, interesting, more than a third of our employees are not U.S. citizens, but they live here. And immigration
is a big
interesting issue. The other thing you just mentioned, actually, one of our investors is one of the largest companies in China. We took Chinese money. When I visited back a few months ago, I can very easily sympathize with the caller that said, or web comment there,
about all the jobs outsourced and built over there.
I was profoundly affected when I most recently visited there. I was
by what? By what, Eric?
The society and the way that it works. My first day there frightened me, actually.
Why?
As an American, because
why?
I looked at it and I saw this economy. It was where the Olympics, Qingdao, where the Olympic sailing competition was.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. There were people swimming on the beach. Saw no poverty.
Oh.
The facilities were unbelievable. Everything worked.
You mean the infrastructure there?
Yeah.
Outclassing ours?
Oh. I'm just saying, you get back there and you fly into New York City and hop in a cab in New York. I mean,
it feels shabby here. But then Qingdao was built for the Olympics. I mean, it's brand new. The whole country of China is not like that. But you saw more
But as an American,
it
profoundly affected me, and it took me a good couple of weeks to sort of get out of my shock to say, you know, I was asking the question, is the war over?
Well,
you know,
so what about it? So is the current generation of entrepreneurs going to help put this country back in the front rank where it has been for a long time? Or is it just going to, you know, add to the luster of Chinese lovely beaches and cities and infrastructure?
Yeah, well, I think that the short answer is we have a huge opportunity here. And that continues on because the innovation still largely, the Chinese company that invested in us came here to invest.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't invest in the Chinese alternatives.
We'll talk about why that is. We'll talk about immigration. Joe in Waltham, Massachusetts, you're on the air, Joe.
Hi. I think you're placing too much emphasis on entrepreneurship and not enough on science and research. Most of the examples that you've given wouldn't even begin to be important without a scientist coming up with the idea and the methodology.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, that's why we're twinning innovation and entrepreneurship. But you're saying look first to the basic science or the scientists,
yes,
Joe?
Absolutely. Science education needs to be supported, and research and development within either small companies or big companies or universities. That's what needs to be developed. And out of ideas that come out of those scenarios, the entrepreneurship will naturally support it.
Joe, everybody here is vigorously shaking their heads. Yes, I mean, and Donna Dubinsky, Eric, you know, they've teamed up with great scientists, as Eric was mentioning, to do this work. But Bill Salmon, how about it then on that front, on the scientific innovation, you know, apart from the entrepreneurs for a second, do we have the stuff?
Tom, you mentioned Thomas Edison. Well, it turns out in Boston, we have a fellow named Bob Langer. Bob Langer has now passed Thomas Edison as the single most prolific patenter in the world. 26 companies have started out of his lab at MIT.
What kind of work? What field?
He deals with drug delivery, various innovations for time-release drugs. But basically, he's created a system that attracts people who are eager not only to advance the science, but to commercialize that science. So going to the caller, it's absolutely the case we underinvest in basic science.
What about education more broadly? Are we creating the ranks, the next ranks of scientists?
In the long term, we have a desperate problem with K through 12 education, and we have an increasing problem in higher ed. And if we don't have a supply of those scientists, if we don't, and indeed it relates to immigration, then 20, 30 years ago, we will not have done the things that we desperately need to do to address the problems and to create jobs in the U.S. So if you think in Andrew's world, the total spending on renewables, efficiency, and nuclear by the Department of Energy was under $1 billion a year for decades.
Mm-hmm.
It's criminal. It's absolutely criminal.
Our investment in our science to keep this country at the forefront.
Right. And so if you were trying to say, one, we need basic science, and then two, we need opportunity. So, for example, if we have feed-in tariffs, if we have a carbon tax.
Feed-in tariff, is that a power, energy arena?
Right. It's a way to pay a higher price for solar energy or for gas that might be produced by Andrew's technology.
Okay.
Now, he's trying to do something really hard, which is to not have to have any subsidy, any feed-in tariff, any carbon tax, and have an economically viable. That's fantastic. But in the short run, if we did two things, increase research, had a price basis that could allow him to make more money in the short run, mm-hmm. we would induce a wave of innovation that would actually have a dramatic impact in the U.S. and around the world.
Andrew Perlman, what about the science behind your venture? Is it made in the USA so far? Do you expect it will continue to be or not? Are you hiring American engineers, foreign engineers, both? What?
So the science all comes out of the U.S. There was some work that was done in places like India and Japan, but the vast majority of it comes out of the U.S. and not necessarily the places that you think of, not necessarily, you know, at MIT or Stanford, places in the middle of the country mm-hmm. at state universities.
Why not?
But there is a difference between where the basic science is taking place and where the innovation and entrepreneurship is. So one of the companies I started in the past, we found the technology in Novosibirsk, Siberia, at the Russian Academy of Sciences, and we mm-hmm. brought that whole team back to the
mm-hmm.
U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that I think basic science is very important, but for creating jobs, and it's extremely important that we put more investment in it, but for creating jobs, I also think you need that infrastructure of venture capitalists and entrepreneurs and innovation.
Which the USA has.
And like I've seen nowhere else in the world. Nowhere. I don't think in China or anywhere else are they willing to take the types of risks, or are people willing to just drop out of school or drop out of their job and just do something completely new? And I think that's what gives us an edge over everywhere else.
Eric Geiler, you mentioned immigration earlier. What's the issue there?
Well,
if we've got all this, you know, spunk and science and spirit and readiness right here in this country, what's the immigration issue?
So I'm not a politician, nor would I sort of profess to be, but when two of my top guys, one's from South America, mm-hmm. one's from China, mm-hmm. they're both living in the United States.
Are these engineers, scientists, or?
PhDs. I mean,
in the sciences.
Extremely bright people.
Poets.
Right. Okay. And both of them in the last year have experienced horrible problems when they've had to leave the United States to get their visa renewed. And then the U.S. immigration authorities, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know, kept one of our guys in Canada for a month. The lost productivity. We couldn't get the guy back in the country.
Immigration has tightened up a lot since 9/11. It's gotten much tougher. And some people say, you know, we're letting in the wrong kinds of immigrants, maybe. But
these are our guys. This is our
guys. But why aren't they American? Can you not find American equivalents to these?
Well, they're educated. Both of them were in this particular case, both educated in the university system in the United States. One
right.
in Kentucky, one at MIT. Both got their PhDs. And then what we're doing is sort of forcing an export of that knowledge.
So keep the law or shape the law so that the best minds in the world can be here to power American enterprises. Linda in Columbia, South Carolina. You're on the air, Linda.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I actually have 2 points. The first is they keep talking, you know, all of your guests have been skirting around the issue of what is this going to do for the United States? And they're talking about other countries. Well, it's good for the other countries to develop because then they'll buy our products. We don't have any products in the United States. So they'll buy the products that our companies make that are being made overseas. My second point, real quick, is on the last guest who, you know, I keep hearing about how we need these people from other countries because we don't have, you know, we need their expertise and their intelligence. I have a student who just graduated from college with a 3.8 and can't get an interview. So everyone telling us that we don't have the students that have the intelligence, yes, we do. We have them here. The companies don't want to pay our students because they can bring them from overseas and pay them less.
Linda, let us pick them both up. Bill Salmon, first to you. Linda's not persuaded that innovation and Americans have reason to be suspicious about, you know, where the jobs flow because they've seen a lot of jobs go overseas. If we get another round of innovation, one more time, is it going to work for Americans?
Tom, first of all, we are all immigrants, and we are all relatively recent immigrants.
In the great sweep of time, quite true.
And to imagine that pulling up the gangplank is going to solve our problems is just not going to happen.
We've had immigrant engineers, you know, as well for decades and decades, centuries working in this.
So I want to staple a green card to every single higher education diploma in the U.S. I want to make it easy for them to go across borders. We are committing economic suicide.
If we don't
keep best and brightest. Now, again, there are individuals who suffer during any transitional period.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We added 2 billion workers to the workforce when China and India opened up and became powerful forces.
The global workforce, yeah.
It is hard to imagine that you would transition quickly to a world in which wages would go up and other places that have to compete. But in the long run, I promise it will have a positive effect. And we will have products.
In the long run, we're all
dead.
I mean, 2 billion people absorbed in the global workforce. What is that, a century's worth or
more? I got it,
but
we have politicians who are on 2-year cycles and 4-year cycles and 6-year cycles. If they continue to tell people that it's not their fault, we've got a policy where we're in denial. It will take time. We've got to do stuff to encourage new jobs. We've got to encourage entrepreneurs. We've
and
got
education,
to encourage
K-12.
Research. We've got to fix K-12 education. And if we do, this will be a great place again.
And so your bottom line message, I guess, here is take heart.
Absolutely. You cannot work with entrepreneurs and not be eternally optimistic. At the same time, don't read the paper.
Or don't read it, or when you read it, get busy and let's do something about the problems that are
every
there.
Every problem is an opportunity.
Yeah. Well, that's an uplifting message, and we root for you guys because we know we need innovation. We're glad to hear what we've got coming. We see the problems on the tracks as well, Bill Salmon, and those clearly need to be addressed. It's been great to have everybody with us this hour. Our thanks again to Donna Dubinsky with Numenta, who joined us from Silicon Valley. Andrew Perlman with Great Point Energy with us in the studio today. Thank you so much, Andrew,
for
being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Eric Geiler, CEO of Y-tricity. Eric, good luck. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
Bill Salmon of Harvard Business School, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.